Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 232 of Game Master's Journey. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. On this show, we discuss the craft and the art of game mastering. I've been running RPGs for over 26 years now, and I produce this show in the hopes that you can benefit from my experience, my triumphs, and my mistakes. I have a great episode for you today. We are going to return to our exploration of the Dungeon Master's Guide with a discussion of the wilderness as an adventure location. And this is going to be the first part of a two-part episode, I guess, in which we're going to be talking about the wilderness as a setting for your adventures. And today we're going to be talking about two approaches you can take to a wilderness journey, the first being the travel montage approach, and the second being the hour-by-hour approach. But before we get into the DMG today, I do have a couple other things I want to talk about at the top of the show. First of all, regarding our community on Google Plus, in case you're not aware, Google has announced that they will be shutting down Google Plus this coming summer, the summer of 2019. So I am going to be shutting down our community on Google Plus, and we will be regrouping on a new community on the MeWe social platform or social media platform, whatever you call it. So you can find a link to the Game Master's Journey community on MeWe in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. So MeWe is very similar to Google Plus or Facebook, with the big exception being that they don't use advertising. They don't collect your data or what you're doing online. And they don't sell your data or what you're doing online to other companies or the Russians or anyone else. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about this, but some people wonder, well, how do they make money then? How do they fund this platform? And the answer to that is they sell premium features. So, for instance, as part of this, there is text chatting, similar to the Google Hangouts text chat, or, you know, those of you like me remember things like AOL, Instant Messenger, ICQ, things like that. So it's like that. So for a fee, you can have double encryption with that, which means both ends of that conversation you're having with someone else by text are encrypted. They have other premium features like getting more emoticons and things like that. And that's how they're going to make their money, which to me seems a lot more above board than bombarding you with ads, or even more so collecting your data and tracking everything you do online and then selling it to reputable or disreputable parties. So I'm really excited about our MeWe community. I've been on the platform for a month or so myself. One of the listeners suggested it to me on Google Plus, and I went and checked it out, and I created the community a week or two ago, and already quite a few of you have joined it. So thank you to all those who've joined it, and to all of you on the Google Plus community, please join the MeWe community, because Google Plus is going away. There's nothing we can do about that. So I want to get everybody over to MeWe before that happens, so we don't lose anyone. I'm also going to be discontinuing the Game Master's Journey forum, mainly because nobody uses it, and there just has been very little activity there since the beginning of the forums. And I really want us to all be in one spot instead of having the community, you know, spread out in all these different places. So, you know, no more Google Plus community and no more forum. And instead, we're going to have the MeWe community. I am, however, going to keep the Discord server for Game Master's Journey because that's a slightly different animal. And is better for real-time discussions and also allows audio and video discussions, and is also something I can use in the future if I want to have people on the show and things like that. So we will still keep the Discord server, and we'll have the MeWe community. So I hope you join us in both places. And finally, I have outlined the episodes for season 13, of which this is the second episode, but there is still some room in there for some more topics to discuss. So if you have an idea of a good topic to discuss, or if you have a question you'd like me to answer, please shoot me an email at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com, and I will do my best to include it in season 13. All right, well, we have a lot to get through today. So without further ado, we're going to move into our discussion of the Dungeon Master's Guide and traveling through the wilderness. So I'm returning to my exploration and discussion of the Dungeon Master's Guide for 5th edition. Today we are going to be in Chapter 5, Adventure Environments. We're going to be discussing the section on wilderness, which starts on page 106. So this is a continuation of an extensive series I've been doing on the Dungeon Master's Guide. We started at the very beginning, and we've made our way to Chapter 5 now. The last episode in this series, we talked about dungeons as far as adventure environments. And yeah, we've covered the whole book up to this point. And before that, I went through the player's handbook and focused in on the more GM side of the screen material. Didn't so much go over all the character options and things like that, but talk more about the rules of the game and running the game and the ins and outs of GMing Dungeons and Dragons as far as the material presented in the player's handbook. So if you go to the show notes for this episode over at starwalkerstudios.com, in the show notes, I will have links to all the previous episodes in the Dungeon Master's Guide series and all of the previous episodes in the player's handbook series. So if you're new to this, you can get all caught up if you want, or go back and listen to an old favorite. Those will all be linked in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. So last time we cracked open our DMG, we talked quite a bit about dungeons, and I believe I said in that episode that dungeons are one of my favorite environments to run and play D&D in, and wilderness environments are one of my other favorites, probably my least favorite setting for a D&D adventure, no matter what side of the screen I'm on, is an urban environment, although that can be fun for a change of pace. I definitely much prefer dungeons and wilderness. So today we're going to tackle the wilderness environment and see what the DMG has to say about it and what kind of tips and tricks we can glean from the DMG. So between the dungeons and settlements of your campaign world lie meadows, forests, deserts, mountain ranges, oceans, and other tracts of wilderness waiting to be traversed. Bringing wilderness areas to life can be a fun part of your game, both for you and your players. And we're going to discuss two different approaches to handling traveling through the wilderness in your game that you can take, and you can actually meld these together as well. And one of the approaches is the travel montage approach, and the other is the hour-by-hour approach. And these are kind of two different sides of the coin, or two different sides of the spectrum, however you want to look at it. Two different, very different approaches to tackling a wilderness journey. And in a nutshell, the travel montage approach kind of glosses over the journey, gives some highlights, but doesn't spend a lot of at the table game time on the journey through the wilderness, where the hour by hour approach does the opposite and focuses in on that journey. And we're going to role play and gameplay through the actual journey. So both of these have their place, and it's not so much a thing of you're going to pick one or the other, and that's the way you always do it. It's going to be based on the needs of a particular game session, the needs of the story that you're telling, which of these you're going to choose. And indeed, you can shift between them at will. You know, so you could be doing a travel montage and go right into a more hour-by-hour approach, and vice versa. So let's dig into each of these and talk about what we mean by these. So first of all is the travel montage approach. So sometimes the destination is more important to you and the players than the journey itself. If the purpose of a wilderness trek is to get the characters to where the real adventure happens, gloss over the wilderness trek without checking for encounters along the way. Just as movies use travel montages to convey long and arduous journeys in a matter of seconds, you can use a few sentences of descriptive text to paint a picture of a wilderness trek in your players' minds before moving on. And I always think of the Indiana Jones movies here. For instance, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Anytime Indiana, you know, gets on a plane or some other mode of transportation and travels to another part of the world, we have the theme music, we get a shot of a map, and we see Indy's route moving along the map, and in a few seconds or minutes, we're able to convey that Indiana just went on a very long journey. He's in a completely different place now. However, the journey itself isn't really important to the story, other than the fact that it happened and then explains how he got from point A to point B. But we're not going to have any adventures along the way or any dialogue or anything that's going to happen that's going to be important to the story. So instead of wasting time with this journey that doesn't really matter, we use the montage to convey that it happened without spending a lot of time on it. And now we can get to our next scene, which is presumably where something exciting and relevant is going to happen. So you can probably think of other movies or TV shows that do this, but Indiana Jones always comes to mind. So if you're not sure what a travel montage is, check out an Indiana Jones movie, and I think all of them have one in there somewhere. So here's some advice on doing a travel montage. Describe the journey as vividly as you like, but keep the forward momentum. For example, you walk for several miles and encounter nothing of interest. Isn't an okay way to present it, but it's far less evocative and memorable than if you said something like, a light rain dampens the rolling plains as you travel north. Around midday, you break for lunch under a lonely tree. There, the rogue finds a small rock that looks like a grinning face, but otherwise, you encounter nothing out of the ordinary. The trick here is to focus on a few details that reinforce the desired mood rather than describing everything down to the last blade of grass. You can call attention to unusual terrain features like a waterfall, a rocky outcropping that offers a breathtaking view over the tops of the surrounding trees, an area where the forest has been burned or cut down, and so on. Also describe notable smells and sounds, such as the roar of a faraway monster, the stench of burned wood, or the sweet aroma of flowers in an elven forest. So this is something great to think about when you're doing prep. So if you're preparing for a session and you know that there's going to be a travel montage or there's likely to be one, you know, jot down a few ideas of these evocative details that you can describe along the way. Sometimes it can be a little difficult to come up with this stuff off the top of your head. So if you have the time before a session, I definitely recommend spending some of that time thinking about the journey and focus in on what do you want to convey about this journey? Do you want to convey some of the strange and unusual and interesting things that the characters see along the way? Do you want to convey how far they've traveled, the fact that they've, you know, been journeying for a very long time and have traveled a great distance and seen many different lands? Do you want to convey the danger of your world? You know, this is something I focus on a lot when I do wilderness travel in my setting of Primordia. Is I usually, whether I'm doing a more round-by-round approach or if I'm doing a travel montage, either way, I usually want to in some way convey the danger of the setting, because part of the shtick of my D&D world is that the wilderness is so dangerous that for the most part, people don't travel within the wilderness. They don't have trade caravans or ships, you know, sailing the seas or things like that, because it is so dangerous. And for the most part, people use magic to travel from place to place instantly via teleportation and things like that. They don't travel, you know, the way people traveled in the Middle Ages here on Earth. So anytime the characters are traveling, whether I'm going to montage it or I'm going to focus in on it more, I really want to illustrate that it is dangerous so that it makes sense to the players that people don't do this and that for the most part, adventurers are the only ones out traveling around. So if I don't think about that when I do my travel montage, and if I just describe amazing things they saw along the way, but don't convey the fact that they were constantly in peril and avoiding monsters that were too powerful to deal with and things like that, if I forget to do that, then I'm not conveying the danger of the setting, and the players might start to wonder, well, why is it that no one ever leaves the cities or travels around? You know, we've been traveling for months and didn't have a single encounter with something dangerous. So, you know, the montage is an opportunity for you to really kind of zero in and focus in on aspects of the setting or the journey that you want to convey without having to have an encounter around it or without having to spend a ton of time at the table dealing with it. You can just, in a few sentences, convey some things and get your point across and then move on to where the story is or where the excitement is, or move on to the next bit of the adventure that you're excited to run. Skip over the boring stuff. So another great suggestion here is that in addition to using evocative language and descriptions to get across some of what the characters are experiencing on this journey, you can also use visual aids to help set the scene. So you can do image searches online and find all kinds of breathtaking landscapes. And in fact, they recommend using that as your search term. Go on Google and just search for breathtaking landscapes, and you'll find a number of examples, both real world and fantasy, to choose from. And not only can these be great ways to show the players the image you already have in your mind, but these kinds of images can also just be a great springboard for an adventure. So if you're ever stumped, or, you know, you have a journey ahead of you and you're not sure what the characters might see along the way, just looking through images like these can give you a lot of great ideas, and you might find the perfect image that you base a whole encounter or even a whole adventure on, because it is so evocative that just looking at it gives you all kinds of ideas. I used to do this a lot when I ran Numenera. I would base a lot of the adventures that I came up with just on some image that I found. And in fact, I was collecting images on Pinterest and on our Google Plus community for my podcast GM Intrusions, which actually became the Game Master's Journey Google Plus community. So all those images are still there, assuming Google Plus is still around when you're listening to this. If not, go find us on MeWe. We'll have a community there. But anyway, I collected images of just cool fantasy and sci-fi or even science fantasy images that I might find online or that other people would find. And I would just collect them on the community or on Pinterest. And then when I needed to come up with an adventure, if I didn't already have an idea of what I wanted to do, I'd just start scrolling through those images. And without fail, one or more of them would jump out at me as something cool and give me some ideas of some kind of cool story or scenario or character or whatever that I could base around this image. And there you go, right away, you've got this springboard for an adventure. And as you need more inspiration, just pull in more images. And so not only do these images help you as a GM to prepare and come up with things, but then there are also things that if you want, you can later show to the players at the table to pull them in even more. Because, you know, like the old saying says, a picture is worth 1,000 words, and maybe even more than 1,000. So you can give the most breathtaking, evocative, poetic description ever with words. But if you can find an awesome painting or picture of the thing you're describing and just show the players that, That's way better in my book. Not only are they going to see what you're seeing in your mind exactly, which they may not when you describe it, but it's also a lot faster. You know, you can look at an image and in a matter of a second or two, get a lot of information and meaning from that image that would take you minutes and minutes of verbal description. So, yeah. And I mean, there is a place for verbal description as well. You know, I can anticipate objections to this. For instance, one cool thing about a verbal description is you're leaving blanks for the players to fill with their own imagination. And sometimes really cool things can come from that, you know, and you'll come across this sometimes when you're discussing the pros and cons of using a grid or a map or something like that versus not. It's the same kind of thing is, well, if you have a grid or a map or whatever of what's in the room, yeah, you can convey a lot of information really quickly and it's all right there and everybody's on the same page. But there is less room for surprises where if you're, for instance, using theater of the mind and you describe a room, you're not going to be able to describe every little thing. And, you know, a player might ask you, hey, are there curtains on the walls? And maybe before you didn't consider whether or not, or curtains on the walls, curtains on the windows. And maybe before you didn't consider if there are curtains or not, but now you can be like, oh yeah, sure, there's curtains. Cause probably the player has some idea involving curtains that they're asking about curtains, right? So if you had a super detailed painting of the room that you're showing them, you know, there's either curtains on the windows in that painting or there's not, right? And we're all on the same page on whether or not there's curtains there. So if there aren't curtains in the painting, then there aren't curtains in the room. And, you know, if the player has a cool idea involving curtains, well, too bad. However, with theater of the mind, as long as I didn't state that there are not curtains in the room, then it could be that there are curtains and I just haven't mentioned them. And so if a player is like, are there curtains? I can say yes, even if maybe there weren't in my mind before, or I just hadn't thought of it. So, you know, any of these techniques, there's going to be pros and cons, which is why, you know, usually I say it's based on the situation and the group that you're with right now, the situation you're in right now, what technique is going to work best for you. So it's not so much a thing of these are the good techniques and these are the bad techniques. For instance, using a grid versus using theater of the mind. I mean, some GMs prefer one over the other. Some players prefer one over the other, but a lot of us use both to some degree or another, depending on what we feel is best for the situation at hand. So it's the same kind of thing with all this stuff. So for instance, to montage or not to montage, it depends on what you're trying to accomplish. So yeah, images can help a lot if you can get some, if you have time to look for them. So as striking as real world scenery can be, wilderness travel can also be used to remind the players that their characters are in a fantasy world or a science fiction world or whatever kind of world they're in. Once in a while, spice up your descriptions with some truly magical element. You know, in Numenera, they always talk about the weird, you know, and you're encouraging Numenera in any description to throw in something weird, some bizarre detail that seems unexplainable. So it's the same kind of thing here with D&D. You know, we want to remind the players and ourselves that we're in a fantasy world. We want to bring in the fantasy element often enough that we're well-grounded in this fantasy setting. So this is a perfect opportunity to do that. So a forest might be home to tiny dragonets instead of birds, or its trees might be festooned with giant webs or have eerie green glowing sap. Use these elements sparingly. Landscapes that are too alien can break up your player's sense of immersion in the world. You want it to be relatable, right? So think of it this way, whether you're describing a character or an object or a landscape or whatever, every fantastic or weird or super scientific or whatever, every, you know, outside normal detail that you throw in kind of distances the player from it a little bit. It breaks the immersion a little bit because we can't relate to it, right? Like if you're telling me about a horse, like I can relate to that. Whether or not I've ridden a horse in real life, whether or not I've seen a horse in real life, like in person, I know what a horse is. I have a really good idea of what horses are like, even if I've never been around them just from movies and television and whatnot. So I can relate to that horse pretty well. If you're describing a unicorn or a Pegasus or a dragon, less so, right? So it's like that with everything. You know, if you're describing something that's real or that exists in our experience, in our world, that's more immersive and more relatable than something that isn't. So you do want to be sparing with the fantastical things, because if you put too much of that in, it does get hard to relate to. And, you know, this is something we think about in world building a lot, or at least I do. And in many, many world building episodes I've done on this show, I've talked a lot about that when designing my world of Primordia, that I wanted there to be cool, fantastical things that maybe you haven't seen before. But at the same time, I didn't want the world to be so strange and alien that the players couldn't relate to it or understand it. But, you know, you may have read books or seen stories or whatever about some fantastical world that's just so out there that you can't really wrap your head around it and you're constantly confused about what's going on. You know, that's not what you want. It's much better to have a world that for the most part is like the world that we're used to, but there's just some notable differences that we can keep track of. So, you know, for instance, with Primordia, I wasn't so much thinking about keeping it relevant to the real world, because I feel like that's something that I kind of do automatically. I was thinking more about keeping it relatable to other D&D settings, or the quote generic D&D setting, whatever that is. So my thought was, if I have a player who's never played with me before, but they have played D&D before, maybe in the Forgotten Realms or Kryn or Greyhawk or whatever, I want Primordia to be different enough from those worlds that the player gets a feeling of, okay, I'm in a distinct world. This isn't Greyhawk. This isn't Forgotten Realms. This isn't Dragonlance. This is something different. So unique enough that they get that feeling of this is a different world. It's not just the same thing as Forgotten Realms with a different name on it. But I didn't want it to be so different that it doesn't feel like a D&D game. So I was very much thinking about these kinds of things, about having some cool elements that are different, but also having lots of touchstones or lots of things that are similar to other D&D worlds, so that we can be grounded in D&D and in that kind of setting and always feel like we're playing D&D and we're not playing some other game, even though we're playing in my world and not one of the canon D&D worlds. So a travel montage is a great opportunity to focus in on some of those details. So for instance, in Primordia, some details that make it different from other worlds is there are two suns, a red sun and a blue sun. So that's something I could be sure to describe during the montage to bring that home. There are auroras, what we call here in the US, the Northern Lights or the Aurora Borealis. Those occur on Primordia pretty much everywhere, every single night. It's as much a part of the night sky as the stars and the moon. So that's something I can describe as well. The night sky of Primordia is a lot brighter because it's closer to the center of its galaxy. There's a lot more stars and nebulas and whatnot in the night sky. So it's a lot brighter at night than it is here on Earth. I usually tell people that a quote dark night on Primordia when the moon isn't full is about the brightness of a full moon here on Earth, a clear full moon on clear night with a full moon on Earth, where a full moon on Primordia is even brighter than that and is more like twilight here on Earth, where it's bright enough to see by. So those are details that I could describe in my montage to remind the players of the things that make this particular world unique, while at the same time focusing in on other details that are more common to fantasy worlds and other details that are things that exist in the real world, so that we can be grounded and have a feeling like we know this place and understand how it works. You can also use the landscape to set the mood and tone for your adventure. In one forest, close-set trees shroud all the light and seem to watch the adventurers as they pass. In another, sunlight streams through the leaves above, and flower-laden vines twine up every trunk. Signs of corruption, rotting wood, foul-smelling water, and rocks covered with slimy brown moss can be a signal that the adventurers are drawing close to the site of evil power that is their destination, or it can provide clues to the nature of the threats to be found there. And that's really cool. And we even have some help with this in 5th edition D&D, because a lot of the cooler and more powerful monsters, a lot of the legendary monsters, have regional effects. So, for instance, powerful dragons and demons and hags and things like that, when you read their entry in the monster manual, it will suggest to you effects that this creature has on the environment around them. And this can not only be a great way to set the tone and the mood and the feel of this area, but it's also a clue to savvy players and characters of what's around, what powerful big bad might be in the area that they might run into or might want to avoid. So savvy characters might notice signs in the terrain that there's a night hag nearby or a red dragon or whatever. And you know, you don't have to be limited to what's given in the monster manual. If you're wanting to use a certain monster for an encounter, you can come up with your own regional effects if they don't have them in the monster manual, especially if you're going to come up with a legendary version of a non-legendary monster, which is something I like to do a lot. Almost any time that I'm going to have an encounter with just one monster or just one or two monsters, a lot of times I will want one or both of those monsters to be legendary, because for the most part, an encounter between player characters and a single monster in 5th edition isn't going to be much challenge or much suspense or fun unless that monster is legendary, because otherwise that monster isn't going to live long enough to really present much of a threat or much drama. You know, that's what legendary monsters are for. They're designed to be able to stand up against a party, at least for a little bit. So I will often take just a normal monster from the game and create a legendary version of it to use in an encounter like that. So if you're going to do that, you can come up with regional effects as well. And this can be another way to really develop your setting, your world. Even if you're running in the Forgotten Realms, there's no reason your Forgotten Realms can't have its own flavor and its own personality. And it should, I would say. So, you know, maybe in your Forgotten Realms, there are super powerful ogres running around that are legendary creatures and have regional effects when they have a lair. And this is something that isn't in the monster manual, something that you would come up with that would be a quirk of your version of the Forgotten Realms. And your players and their characters, as they adventure and encounter these ogres, could learn what those regional effects are and could recognize those. So maybe they travel into a new wilderness area and they see signs. They see these regional effects of a powerful ogre nearby. And now, even though they haven't seen that ogre, you foreshadowed it and they're looking for it because they've seen signs of it. And especially when you pull that off with something that you've created yourself for your own world or your own version of a stock D&D world, those are really cool, because just kind of the nature of the game these days, you know, it's a lot different than when I started playing, you know, D&D close to 30 years ago. You know, back in those days, it was very common to have players at your tables who hadn't even read the player's handbook, you know, definitely hadn't read the monster manual or the DMG, you know. And in fact, I knew old school DMs who, you know, forbade players from reading the monster books or the DMG or whatever. And it's not like that anymore. Nowadays, most players at your table have probably read the books, unless they're completely new to the game. They've probably read the DMG. They've probably read the monster manual. And even more than that, they've likely been on forums or whatever online. And, you know, there's just, with the internet now, there's just a lot more sharing of information among players. So it just seems to me, as someone who's been running D&D for close to 30 years, that more players today come to the table with knowledge that 30 years ago only the DM would have. So they're going to know things about the monsters in the monster manual. And, you know, even a player that's really good at separating player and character knowledge and isn't having their character act with knowledge about, for instance, red dragons that they wouldn't have, the player still knows. So the player is pretending that they don't know that this is a red dragon's lair, even though the player knows. They're pretending their character doesn't know. And it's just not as fun as when the player doesn't actually know what's going on. And when the player is surprised when they find out, oh, we've been in the red dragon lair all this time. So that's one thing nice about homebrewed stuff or your own variations of things is you can surprise and delight the players with new information or new secrets that they discover about your world and what's going on. So for instance, with our example with the legendary ogres, you know, players come to the table, they don't know anything about a legendary ogre. I really hope there's not some kind of legendary ogre in the monster manual now, since I'm just using this as an off-the-cuff example. I don't think there is, but even if there is, it doesn't matter. The point is we've taken a monster that isn't legendary and we've created our own legendary version. You know, that's new to the players and they're going to be surprised by that. And they're going to have to learn what those regional effects are and what the legendary actions of one of your ogres are. They can't just look it up in a book or look it up online. They have to discover it in game, the old fashioned way. So that can be a lot of fun for players and it can be very, very immersive and pull them into the setting and the story even more. So that's great stuff to do when you can. So it goes on to say that specific wilderness areas in your world might have their own special features. For example, the spirit forest and the spider haunt woods might feature different kinds of trees, different kinds of flora and fauna, which is to say plants and animals, different weather and different random encounter tables. Finally, when you're doing a wilderness trek, you can enhance it by calling attention to the weather. And this is something that people often forget, and especially I think people who live in cities often forget to talk about is the weather. What's going on with the weather? You know, if every day is room temperature and sunny in your world, that's pretty boring. You know, some days are going to be hot, some days are going to be cold, some days are going to be humid. You know, there's going to be storms and wind and all kinds of things. So that's something you can think about too, that can spice things up. So for instance, if you say you spend the next 3 days crossing the swamp, that sounds a lot less harrowing than if you say you spend the next 3 days trudging through knee-deep mud, the first 2 days and nights in the pouring rain, and then another day under the beating sun with swarms of hungry insects feasting on your blood. And that's another great thing to remember that people often forget is insects, you know. Traveling through the woods is one thing. Traveling through the woods while being mobbed by swarms of mosquitoes is a totally different thing. So that's something you can pull in as well. All right, so we talked a lot about the montage approach and, you know, different things you can think about when doing a montage. And you know, really just to kind of wrap up the whole montage thing, you know, my advice to you would be watch some montages. It's such an often used technique in movies and television shows. And there's not just traveling montages, there's training montages, right? Like that's a really popular one. You know, especially like, for instance, in like all the superhero movies, you'll usually, you know, have some kind of training montage where, you know, Spider-Man's learning to use his new web shooters or whatever. So there are lots of examples out there of montages that you can pull from to get some ideas of how to do your own montages. And overland travel is just one situation in which you can use montages in your game. You can use them anytime that you want to kind of gloss over something. You want to convey that something has happened, but you don't want to spend a bunch of time at the table with it. A montage can be a great way to handle that. And one of the perfect examples of that is when the player characters take a long voyage. But that's not the only way that you can approach a long voyage. The second way that we're going to talk about today is what in the DMG they call the hour by hour approach. So sometimes a journey deserves as much time and attention as a destination. Cool things are going to happen on this journey and you want to enjoy them. If wilderness travel features prominently in your adventure and isn't something you want to gloss over, you will need more than a descriptive overview to bring a long and harrowing journey to life. You'll need to know the party's marching order and have encounters at the ready. Now, right now, I want to just point out something that's probably obvious to most of us, but just in case it's not, and even if it is, just to remind us all, you don't have to use these techniques in isolation, and usually you're not. Now, the montage you might use in isolation, you probably will on a regular basis, just be like, hey, you guys traveled for a week. This is kind of what happened. Moving on, right? That's really useful. But what I'm more thinking about is this hour by hour approach. Even when you decide to do that, a lot of times you're not going to do that for the whole journey because it would just take too long and it would get too boring and too repetitive. An example that always comes to my mind when we talk about this kind of approach is the Odyssey. So if you know the story about the Odyssey or the story of the Odyssey, it's a story of Odysseus trying to return home after the Trojan War. And it's a story of all the adventures and misadventures he has on the way as the gods, chief among them Poseidon, try to keep him from getting home. Now, when you read the Odyssey, you read a lot of tales of a lot of places Odysseus visits, monsters he encounters, gods he encounters, different conflicts he has with different characters in the world. And, you know, that's what most of the Odyssey is all these different tales, you know. He encounters all kinds of different things and has all kinds of adventures, but the Odyssey doesn't tell you every single adventure he has along the way. It alludes to ones that it doesn't really go into detail on. And, you know, there's probably different reasons for that, but a couple reasons I can think of is, one, you know, we don't want the tale to be too long. And two, you know, there's only so many of these crazy adventures we can chain together before it's just too much and we start getting tired of it, or they start to seem the same, or we just get bored with it, right? There's like a limit to how much of a thing you can take. So the same thing with a D&D game. Okay, if your players are taking this long journey that's maybe going to take them 6 months, you don't want to take the hour by hour approach for a 6 month journey for the entire thing, because, well, for one thing, it might take you years of real world gameplay to get through that. And for another thing, long before you complete that 6 month journey, the players are going to be sick of it. You're going to be sick of it and you're not going to want to do it anymore. A perfect example of this is from the Tyranny of Dragons campaign. In, I believe, the first half of that campaign, there's a chapter where the player characters are on a caravan. And most people that I've heard talk about this campaign, that's, if not their least favorite part of the campaign, it's one of their least favorite part of the campaign. And a lot of DMs actually skip it or will montage through that because it's just a really long, painful part of the campaign where nothing really interesting is happening. It's just journeying on a caravan and the adventure presents some things for the player characters to do, but it's not terribly interesting or fun. And it just drags on for way too long. You know, I've talked about that campaign extensively in previous episodes. And, you know, one of my main takeaways from it, if I ever ran it again, was I would not do that chapter. I would skip it. I would just do a short montage of that whole part of the campaign and move on, because it was unfun. And we just wanted it to be over. So my point is even if you decide to do this hour by hour approach, you're probably not going to want to do it for the entire journey. You're going to want to pick like highlights that you want to zero in on. And for the rest of the journey, you can use the montage approach to get through those parts and get to the cool stuff. All right. So for those parts of the journey that you're going to use this hour by hour approach, you're going to need some encounters or encounter tables or both. And it's good to have a marching order for the players so that, you know, as they're traveling, you know, assuming something's, they're going to walk into something, say, or encounter something along the way, who's going to see it first, who's going to see it last, you know, who's bringing up the rear, who's in front, that kind of thing. And marching order is simplified in fifth edition. You just have three ranks. You have the front rank, the middle rank, and the back rink. And it's funny because pretty much any time I ask players for a marching order, they give me this really detailed, like, this person's in the very front and this person's next to them and these two characters are side by side, and they give me way more information than I need or want. Really, as a GM, all you really need to worry about or care about is those three ranks, because the front rank, these are the characters in the very front. If they're walking into something, they're the ones that are going to encounter it first. So if there's a trap on the trail, they're the one that's going to hit the trap first. Or if there's a monster ahead of them, they're the one that's going to see the monster first, that kind of thing. The rear rank is the opposite. They're the ones in the back. So if something comes on them from behind, they're the ones that are going to deal with it first. Or if someone or something is trying to follow them, they're the ones that are going to have the chance to notice it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then your middle rank is just everybody that's not in the front or the back. And really, that's all the granularity we need for D&D. We don't need, you know, if you've got six characters in your party, you don't need six ranks. You just need the three. It's really all you need to worry about. So let your players determine the party's marching order. And there's more on the player's handbook about that. We just talked about it a little bit. You could also refer to my episodes on the player's handbook where we talk about it even more. Characters in the front rank are likely to be the first to notice landmarks and terrain features, as well as the ones responsible for navigating. Characters in the back rank are usually responsible for making sure that the party isn't being followed. Encourage characters in the middle ranks to do something other than blindly trudge along behind the front rank characters. Player's Handbook suggests activities such as map making and foraging for food, and we discussed those in previous episodes. See the show notes for more. Wilderness journeys typically feature a combination of planned encounters, encounters that you prepare ahead of time, and random encounters, encounters determined by rolling on a table. Again, encounters and random encounters are subjects I've talked about a lot on this show. I don't so much use random encounters. I have what I call story encounters, or what they call planned encounters here. And then now I'm blanking on the term. I have a term for what I use instead of random encounters, which are basically, they're still encounters I plan, but they're encounters that aren't tied to a specific place or a specific time. They're just encounters I can use whenever I need an encounter. So it's basically like a random encounter, only I've done some planning and building of the encounter ahead of time, as far as, you know, what kind of creatures are there, how many, what kind of tactics do they use, what kind of treasure might they have, what kind of tools do they have to use in the encounter, that kind of thing. Wow, I can't believe I've forgotten my term for that. I'm sure I'll get plenty of emails and whatnot of people reminding me of my term. But basically, story encounters and non-story encounters are how I approach it. So a planned encounter, or what I call a story encounter, might need a map of the location that it takes place in. For example, a ruin or a bridge spanning a gorge, or some other memorable, exciting location. And random encounters tend to be less location specific, or non-story encounters. So they're encounters you can kind of use in a lot of different places. So the fewer planned encounters you have, or the fewer story encounters you have, the more you'll need to rely on random or non-story encounters to keep the journey interesting. So you can see chapter 3 of the DMG for advice on creating random encounter tables, when to check for random encounters, and all that stuff. And again, you know, this is stuff we've talked about in previous episodes. So you can see the show notes to find those. So a good way to keep wilderness encounters from becoming stale is to make sure they don't all start and end the same way. In other words, if the wilderness is your stage and your adventure is the play or the movie, think of each wilderness encounter as its own scene. And this is exactly how I think about it. I'm pretty influenced by the old World of Darkness games, Vampire the Masquerade, Changeling the Dreaming especially. And that's how those games were presented. You always think in scenes, and that's how I approach it. So try to stage each of these scenes in a slightly different way to keep things interesting. So if one encounter comes at the adventurers from the front, the next one might come at them from above or behind. If an encounter features stealthy monsters, a character tending to the party's pack animals might get the first indication that monsters are near when a pony whickers nervously. If an encounter features loud monsters, the party might have the option to hide or set an ambush. One group of monsters might attack the party on sight, and another might allow safe passage for food. So yeah, just keep things interesting. Don't fall into ruts of always doing things the same way. Think of ways to change things up. You use different types of monsters, different threat levels. You know, if one encounter is going to be really hard, maybe make another one that's easier. Just keep things interesting and keep the players guessing about what's coming next. Reward characters for searching while they travel by providing things for them to find. Broken statues, tracks, abandoned campsites, and other finds can add flavor to your world, foreshadow future encounters or events, or provide hooks for further adventures. And yeah, those are all great things you can do by just giving out little details that a character who's making an effort to search things finds. And, you know, these are things you can come up with on the fly, too. You don't necessarily have to plan that kind of stuff ahead of time. And a lot of times it can be a waste of time to do so. I mean, think about it. You're going to run this overland wilderness trek, this traveling, you know, adventure. And you come up with all these random things that maybe aren't random, that foreshadow, you know, creatures and events coming in the future. You come up with all these things ahead of time in the hopes that players will find them. But then you run the adventure and none of the players search anything. None of them, you know, take time to investigate anything. And so all those details go unused unless you figure out some way to use them. So, you know, that can be a waste of time. So sometimes a better approach is to maybe come up with some ideas of things like that you could do if needed, but don't really spend a lot of time on it until players start doing a lot of searching as the game is running, and then you can kind of start coming up with stuff to reward that searching and also perhaps foreshadow things that are coming. So, you know, once you're running with a given group of players for a while or a given group of characters for a while, you'll probably know, you know, if they're going to be doing a lot of searching and investigating or not. But, you know, in the beginning, when you don't know, like with a new group or a new campaign, you know, I wouldn't spend a ton of time preparing that stuff ahead of time unless you're going to find other ways to use it if the player characters don't actually search for anything. So a wilderness journey could take multiple sessions to play out. And that said, if the wilderness journey includes long periods with no encounters, use a travel montage approach to bridge gaps between encounters. And yeah, I already kind of talked about that a little bit, but I think, you know, the best thing is using these together. And you know, it depends on the length of the journey, but if you're talking a long journey, it may not be satisfying for the players to montage the entire thing, right? You know, oh, we crossed an ocean, or we went from, you know, one end of the continent to the other, and we're going to montage the whole thing. That seems like a little bit of a letdown, but you also don't want to do play-by-play for the whole thing, or you'll be doing that travel for months or years of real world time. So, you know, as is often the case, the middle ground is where you want to be. So come up with some really cool encounters that are going to highlight some really cool things that they see, or some cool regions that they go through, or some cool monsters they come up against. Plan those encounters and then use montages, as they say, to connect, you know, to fill the space between those few encounters that you've chosen, and boom, there you have your wilderness travel. And you can even decide how many sessions you want it to take. So if you want to get through this voyage in one session or less, then maybe just come up with one or two or three encounters and montage the rest of it. And, you know, you can do that in one session or even part of a session and move on with the adventure. If you want it, maybe you want to spend two or three sessions traveling, then you'll have more encounters and more stuff to montage. It's really up to you. How long do you want to spend on the journey. All right. And with that, I'm going to hit pause on our discussion of wilderness adventures from the DMG. We're getting close to an hour at this point. So we will continue this discussion in episode 233. So let me know what you think about the montage approach and about the hour by hour approach. Do you prefer one over the other, or do you use them both together as I do? And any thoughts you have on those approaches, any advice for other GMs, I'd love to hear it. And it's something I can share with the other listeners in a future episode. All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for episode 232 of Game Master's Journey. If you would like to get a hold of me and discuss gaming or the show or whatever's on your mind, there are a lot of great ways you can do that. You can shoot me an email at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. You can also call our voicemail, 951-GMJ-LEX-1. That's 951-465-5391, or you can find that in the show notes. And you can leave me a message. You can also join our community on MeWe and Discord. You can find links for those in the show notes as well. And if you have any comments, questions, or feedback on the show, I would love to hear from you. You can find the show notes for this and all the episodes at starwalkerstudios.com/Game Master's Journey. Finally, if you enjoy the show and you'd like to help support Game Master's Journey, you can find all the great ways to do so at starwalkerstudios.com/support, or just follow the support link in the show notes. I even have options for you that won't cost you anything. The best way you can support the show and my RPG endeavors is to check out my latest self-published D&D supplement, Relics of Power. And I want to thank everyone who's been purchasing Relics of Power as well as the Trickster's Labyrinth lately. I really appreciate everyone who's been checking those out. It really helps out a lot. And you can also show your support for the show by getting a Game Master's Journey t-shirt. However you decide to help the show out, I really, really appreciate it. So I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. And I hope you have a chance to run your favorite RPG. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/Game Master's Journey.